This episode of The Transmission is brought to you by Audible.com, the leader in spoken word entertainment.
Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. For details, go to audiblepodcast.com/transmission.
The Transmission, episode 55, March 8, 2009.
Wherever John went, he's gone. And wherever we are is before that well was ever built.
Yeah, I'd say way before.
Aloha from the really rainy, wet island, Lost fans. You are tuned into The Transmission. This is a podcast devoted to the show Lost on ABC. I'm Jen.
And I'm Ryan, and we're here to discuss the latest great episode of Lost, Le Fleur. So here's how we're going to break it down.
We'll recap the episode in 8 minutes or less.
And then we're going to look at it in greater detail.
We'll hear from you all, everybody, in our feedback segment.
And then we'll step into the forward cabin to look ahead at what's coming up on Lost. So, you ready?
Let's get lost.
This is the 8th episode of Season 5 of Lost, entitled Le Fleur, and, well, I guess we have one really far flashback, a kind of flashback, and then a flashback, so let's go chronologically starting at the beginning.
Sawyer finds himself holding on to the other end of the rope leading into the ground where the well and Locke used to be. Mm-hmm. Juliet says they're now there before the well was built. Miles says way before and points to a giant statue.
Down below, Locke hobbles to the frozen donkey wheel and turns it, and, well, Sawyer, Juliet, Jin and Miles flash again. They notice that the last flash felt different, like an earthquake, and the well is back, but it's filled in.
Juliet and Miles say their headaches are gone and their nosebleeds have stopped. Juliet says, John did it. It's over. Jin asks, now what? Sawyer says that they'll wait for Locke and wait as long as it takes.
They find Daniel muttering in the jungle, and he's saying that Charlotte is gone, and wherever and whenever they are now, they're there for good. Sawyer says they should go back to the beach, and Miles gets a little wise, but Juliet backs Sawyer up and they all go along.
As they walk, they hear gunshots and a woman screaming. They see two men put a bag over a woman's head. Miles asks Daniel about not getting involved, but Daniel says it doesn't matter what they do.
So they get involved. Juliet shoots one man, Sawyer shoots the other, and they pull the bag off the woman's head. Juliet says that the man she was with is wearing a Dharma uniform circa 1970s or 80s, and the woman asks who they are.
Sawyer says that their ship wrecked on the island on the way to Tahiti. She mentions the truce and says that they have to bury the men and bring Paul back home. She says that Paul was her husband.
On the way back, Sawyer says he'll do the talking since he's used to lying for a living. They reach the sonic fence and Juliet panics. The woman says it's off and walks through unharmed, but when they try to follow her, they all get zapped. Turns out she was wearing earplugs.
Sawyer wakes up in the rec room. Horace thanks him for saving the woman, Amy. He explains that they have a certain defense protocol because they don't get along with the indigenous islanders.
Sawyer spins a tale saying that his name is Jim Le Fleur and that they were all aboard a salvage vessel looking for an old slave ship called the Black Rock.
Horace buys this story but says that they're all going to have to leave on the sub the next day. Sawyer says he wants more time to look on the island for the rest of the crew, but Horace says that they're not Dharma material.
Meanwhile, Daniel, Miles, Juliet, and Jin are waiting for Sawyer, and Juliet explains that she used to live there in Othersville, but she wasn't Dharma, she came later. Daniel, meanwhile, mutters that the record is spinning again, we're just not on the song that we want.
Daniel spots a little red-haired girl and says that it's Charlotte. Horace arrives with Sawyer and says Mr. Le Fleur will explain. Sawyer says they're being shipped off to Tahiti.
Suddenly, alarm goes off and people start running around and shouting. It's Richard Alpert coming to town, and Horace goes out to him. Alpert says, that fence may keep other things out, but not us. You've broken the truce. Where are my two men?
Horace comes back and asks Sawyer where the bodies are. Sawyer goes out to talk to Alpert himself and says that the truce is still on as he's not with the Dharma Initiative.
Sawyer tells Alpert that he knows all about the bomb and a bald man who disappeared 20 years ago. He says that man's name is John Locke and I'm waiting for him to come back. Albert says, well, my people still need some kind of justice.
They go to Amy and tell her that they want Paul's body. She takes a necklace, it's an ankh, from around his neck. Horace tells Sawyer that the sub comes back in 2 weeks and they can stay during that time and find the crew.
Sawyer finds Juliet on the pier and tells her that they've got 2 weeks to wait for Locke. But Juliet says the flash has stopped, Locke has already saved them, and that she's going to leave.
Sawyer says she has nothing to go back to, but Juliet says, well, that's not a reason to stay. He says he needs someone to get his back and tells her to give him 2 weeks.
Well, 3 years later, and Darmite's Jerry, Phil, and Rosie are having a hootenanny in the Pearl. Rosie notices that someone is at the security fence, and it's Horace. He's drunk and setting off sticks of dynamite.
They run to wake Lafleur, who is, of course, Sawyer, now head of security. He picks up Miles and says, our fearless leader is out blowing up trees. They pick him up and bring him back to Amy.
Amy says that they had a fight about Paul, but before she can explain, she goes into labor. The Dharma doctor says that the baby's in breach and he doesn't know what to do, as their women usually deliver on the mainland.
Sawyer goes to the motor pool and pulls Juliet out from under a Dharma van. He says that Amy needs help, but every time that she's tried to deliver a baby, it hasn't worked. He says she needs to try.
Juliet takes over the delivery and Sawyer goes out and meets Jin. Jin reports that his search turned up no sign of our people, and Sawyer says that they're going to keep looking. Juliet comes out and says it's a boy.
Sawyer is walking through Othersville and he picks a sunflower on his way home to Juliet, who is making dinner. He says that she was amazing today and she thanks him for believing in her, and they kiss.
Next, we see Horace coming to, and Sawyer says, well, the good news is you're a dad, but the bad news is you missed your son's birth. Horace explains that he found Paul's necklace and asks, it's only been 3 years that he's been gone. Is that long enough to get over someone?
Sawyer says he had a thing for a girl once, but he didn't go for it, and wondered if he'd ever stop thinking about her. Now he can't remember her face. She's just gone. He says 3 years is long enough.
Sawyer and Juliet are sleeping when the phone rings, and it's Jin. Sawyer tells him not to bring them in and to meet in the North Valley instead. We see Jin drive up in the van, Hurley gets out, Jack gets out, and finally, it's Kate.
And Thud.
And that is Lafleur in under 8 minutes, so when we come back, we'll look at this episode in greater detail.
We can't wait to share our thoughts on Lafleur, and we'd like to get to yours and you all, everybody. But first, we want to let you know that today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider in spoken word entertainment.
Audible has over 50,000 titles to choose from to be downloaded and played back anywhere, just like the transmission. And thanks to Audible.com, you can get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today.
If you've always wanted to read the many books mentioned on Lost, Audible.com is a great way to go. For example, you can pick up Valis by Philip K. Dick. It's unabridged and narrated by Tom Wiener.
Now, of course, Valis was actually mentioned and discussed in the show itself when John Locke selected it for Ben to read while he was holding Ben prisoner in Ben's own house. And Ben had said, well, I already read it, and John gave good advice to Ben and to fans when he said, you might catch something you missed the second time around.
One reviewer on the site writes, Valis is like Naked Lunch meets Life of Brian.
Sounds
it's
good to
it's
me.
Really kind of an semi-autobiographical, weird, trippy voyage through time, and I can't wait to read it, actually. And you can make it your free pick with this offer.
Just go to audiblepodcast.com/transmission.
That's audiblepodcast.com/transmission.
So, Lafleur, you know, we got through it in 6 minutes because, in a way, not a lot happened, and yet I think a lot did. So, what did you think about Lafleur?
It was amazing. This is one of my favorite episodes ever. Easily in my top 10.
Of all episodes of Lost?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, easily. You know, I really liked it. I really did. And I liked it against all odds. I'm not sure if I'd put it in my top 10, but I could actually list out so many reasons why I wouldn't like it. I mean, one, it had a lot of time jumping. It was using it as a gimmick to a large extent. You had the title card saying 3 years ago, 3 years later. They introduced new characters, gave them names, new faces, and you know, we're responding badly so far, I think, to other new characters. So on many, many levels, you know, Lafleur shouldn't have worked, but something about it really, really worked for me. I thought it was a great character-driven episode.
It had everything. It had a little bit of mythology, it had a little bit of character, and I gotta say, Josh Holloway, he kicks butt.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was a wonderful showcase for him. I mean, we haven't had character flashbacks for a while, and we haven't had a Sawyer story for a long time. And this one just reminded us in many ways why that kind of model worked. I mean, this was very reminiscent of a season one episode where you see where they are now, sort of now, and where they were a little while ago, and kind of shows you the progression of their character. And in this case, I think it was totally believable. It's amazing to me that we have a new relationship, a new romance on the show, and even though it was just introduced, I mean, there were hints of it, of course. There were little funny looks and pauses, but to basically have it come to full fruition in one episode from wherever they were to, you know, spooning on a lovely afternoon to Juliet can cook and Sawyer settle down and just really amazing, wonderful stuff and seemingly out of nowhere, but again, totally believable.
I mean, can you believe how far Sawyer has come as a character?
I know.
My favorite shot ever is of him cross-legged inside the hollowed-out engine reading the letter, and everybody hates him and nobody trusts him, and he's hoarding stuff, and now he's lecturing Horace on how to be a good husband, and it's totally, like you said, totally believable.
Right. I mean, in many ways, I can almost imagine reading the script without the performances and thinking to myself, I don't know if we can sell this. I don't know if we can go this far with these characters. And it was Josh Holloway. It was Elizabeth Mitchell, brilliant all the way. I mean, so for many, many reasons and against all odds, I really enjoyed listening.
So what's their name?
What do you mean?
What's Sawyer and Juliet's cutesy?
Oh, you mean like Jate or Skate? Well, let's see. Jawyer? No, I don't know.
Fork?
Where's the...
Ford and
yes.
Burke.
Ford and Burke. Fork. Okay, well, I guess that sounds better than like Juliet and stuff, so I'll take Fork. So are we now Forkers?
Yes, we're Forkers. That sounds positively dirty.
Anyhow, so yes, a very, very good episode. Of course... early on, we know where the episode is going. We know because this is a flashback to right before what we saw at the end of the previous episode, which is Jin discovering everybody back on the island. So we knew that the inevitable moment of Sawyer seeing Kate was going to happen. And that's a little discouraging, I think.
I actually felt a little tiny twinge of disappointment, you know?
Maybe they could have put that off till the next episode, maybe. But you knew because of all of the telegraphing, it was, you know, to use my favorite word, to be anvilicious, they're talking about is 3 years long enough. So you know he's going to be faced with that question before the end of the episode. But, I mean, I don't know. I like this relationship a lot, and it's almost... too unbelievable to me that Sawyer could actually be tempted by Kate now, because if you think about it, Sawyer and Kate had a great chemistry, a great bad boy, good girl, who's actually good boy, bad girl thing going on.
Uh-huh.
But in everything that we've seen leading up through time, they actually spent, what, 100 and something days together on the island? Sawyer and Kate's relationship was not that long.
Right.
And now we're to believe that, Sawyer and Juliet have been together, maybe courting or whatever, but
for three years
they've been with each other. So how can that relationship in any way, you know, be threatened by the arrival of Kate? So I'm hoping that there's some realism interjected, that we don't get immediately back to love triangles or quadrangles, and that, there's going to be at least some time for this, I think, wonderful relationship to work out.
Yeah, I think so. So it seems like the 3 years that have gone by for Sawyer and Juliet and company, it's gone a lot better than it has for the Oceanic Six.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's not accidental at all that they've picked this 3-year time span to jump, because we've now seen pretty much all of the Oceanic Six's 3 years unfold.
Yep.
And both sets of these people, our left-behinders and our Oceanic Sixers, have spent 3 years living a lie, telling lies, pretending to know or not know things that they actually
pretending to be somebody that they're not.
Pretending to be other people. And for whatever reason, they're saying, hey, you know, they left the island and their 3 years went to hell. These folks spent 3 years and they've integrated into it and they're living a happy domesticated life. Now, I'm not sure if that's the truth of those 3 years. I'm wondering if they're going to spend any amount of time returning to this 3-year time span. Part of me thinks maybe they shouldn't. I one of the best things about Lafleur is that it leaves a lot of that 3-year time span to the imagination.
That's true.
So I'm not sure if there's a lot of that history that we're going to need to see. In fact, one of my favorite things is imagining the Sawyer and Juliet courtship. I mean, that I think has been my daydream lately. immediately after seeing this episode is how could that have possibly gone? The first time Sawyer makes a pass at Juliet, she has got a laugh in his face, you know?
Yeah, of course.
And he's going to have like that wounded puppy dog look. And I mean, just how that all worked out, it's better in my head than it is on the show. But it is a good key that you're right. The 3 years for both of them, they both had some pretty interesting 3 years. But when they sit down and have a talk and say, hey, what's been going on, folks? I'd feel kind of bad to be the Oceanic Six people.
Well, you know what somebody mentioned on the blog, and I can't remember who said this, and I really apologize, but Sawyer and Juliet and Jack and Kate are kind of mirror images of each other.
How so?
A doctor and a criminal.
Aha. Hey, that's actually kind of a nice observation. So kudos to you. The only thing that I think, you know, and someone did raise the objection on the blog, is that you have this island where bad things happen and mysterious things are going on, and they were recently under attack, and it seems that they basically did get comfortable with the Dharma Initiative pretty quickly. I think the only character for whom I think staying on the island was not sold well was Miles.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Sawyer and Juliet knows the island, and Sawyer asked her to stay behind, and he wants to get more information. You can see easily how they got to where they are. Even Daniel, who's missing, Faraday, you know, 3 years later, we know that he's now part of the construction crew building the underground
hatch.
Oh,
that's right.
So he's not necessarily going to go disappear because he wants to know more about the island. But Miles, what is it that makes Miles stay? Why does he say, after he's so snarky and saying, you know, it doesn't sound like a bad deal to get on that sub to go to Tahiti, I agree with him. If I was in his position going through what I was going through, why wouldn't I leave? That's the only one. I'm wondering if that's a question that's going to be answered.
I hope so, because it doesn't, I mean, it's, I think, a stretch of the imagination to even think of why any of them would really want to stay. I mean, the sub is looking like a pretty good deal, but mm-hmm. Miles is definitely the one where I'm wondering why he's not leaving.
Yeah, he would be the most practical about it and say, you know what, I know how the next 10 years of World Series games are going to go. I'm going to go out and bet myself into a mansion, you know, or something. But, oh well. Again, they could revisit these 3 years, but part of me thinks it's even better if they just sort of like doo-doo-doo and pretend it's not there and just let us fill in the blanks ourselves. Now, of course, there wasn't a heck of a lot of mythology, but there were a couple of key points, and I think the big giant one and the one with most of the conversation and you all, everybody, has got to be the four-toed statue.
I actually woohooed when we saw the statue.
Yes, we yelled out loud, we cheered, and of course, it couldn't have been more perfect for Lost that they give you the statue, but for only a minute.
And from behind.
And from behind. So you think you're going to get it. It's another tease. It's just as much of a tease as pointing out the four-toed statue in the first place. But in many ways, I think it paid off for a lot of people because they're saying, basically, we haven't forgotten this, and this is not insignificant, or at least we hope so.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty cool. I mean, we could talk about what you and I think that it is, but I think mm-hmm. we can just save that for you all, everybody, because that's really where the brilliance of this show is, and that's in the fans. And, you know, folks have come up with great names. Bastet, Anubis, Horus, Seth, Toweret, Isis, Osiris, all kinds of fantastic names. Did any of them that you like the most?
Well, given what Toweret allegedly stands for, I kind of like her a lot.
Well, that's our tease. You're just going to have to listen to hear what everybody has to say. And another thing that I liked that I should mention before I forget, Jin speaking English, which we predicted was going to happen.
Right.
And of course, was handled perfectly. Nobody comments on it. It's not, you know, it's just thrown in as part of the conversation that, you know, I searched the grids. How long are we going to search? You know, I think that was fantastic. And so moving forward, you know, good old Daniel Day Kim gets to hopefully speak better than non-English. So that's definitely cool. Well, okay. So the other mythology things. Well, Faraday, as we mentioned, we don't know where he is 3 years later, but presumably he's also in the scientific core for the Dharma Initiative.
Mm-hmm.
But when we do see him 3 years earlier, he's rocking back and forth saying, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to tell her. Basically, he's trying to tell himself he's not going to tell Charlotte not to leave the island.
Right.
So I guess the question is he going to succeed in that or not?
No, I think he actually loves her. And I think he's going to do whatever he needs to do to save her life.
He's not
going
to be able to resist that. I also think that if you believe what Faraday says is whatever happened, happened. I mean, he did not stop them from interfering with Amy and Paul. So, you know, clearly he basically is that, you know, confident in the persistence of events in time. So I don't think he's going to be able to avoid it either. But it would be interesting to see that moment. And I think they're definitely leading up to it. The only question I think that is reasonable is that Ben says when he identifies who Charlotte is, says that Charlotte Staples Lewis, born at 1979.
Yes.
If we're in 1977, she is not a four-year-old girl running around in a dress.
No.
So that is, I mean, I think there are some timeline issues with this episode. We might get to some of them in our later segment with the listeners. I mean, again, where's Ben? A lot of people are asking. Ben does not arrive on the island until the late 70s, maybe 1977 or so, but clearly we're in that neighborhood. So because Sawyer hasn't said anything about this creepy guy Ben one or creepy young child Ben running around, I'm just going to presume that that moment hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, I'm guessing so. Speaking of Sawyer and Albert, I really liked their moment together.
Oh, definitely. You know, I mean, again, Sawyer being able to come up with a story that anybody will believe is one thing, but Sawyer completely blowing the mind of a character who you would believe isn't easily fazed was very well handled. And I thought it was kind of that entire interaction, I think, was great because it gives us a little bit of more information. I mean, Richard Alpert, you know, comes in and says that fence might stop other things, but not us. So clearly he's making a reference there to the smoke monster. Mm-hmm. And also that raises the question is why aren't the others or the indigenous hostiles affected by the smoke fence? Now, they also point out in this episode that the fence has different grades of intensity. You know, it can be kind of low and give you a headache, or it can kill you, I guess.
Like Mikhail.
Right,
yeah.
So I think that was kind of key, but the real question is, who is Richard Alpert? What is he like? And one thing that I'm kind of picking up now, especially with the Egyptian episodes, is that maybe our indigenous islanders are something that are, as some folks have said, pretty close to not being alive. I mean, that's one way that your ears or your hearing or your brain won't be fried by an electric fence, is if you're not actually a living person.
Yeah, that would do it, yeah.
I don't know. Well, that's definitely getting close to kind of, you know, difficult
zombies.
To explain zombies, I guess. But whatever, you know, we're definitely sold on the show. But it's kind of hard not to go there. I mean, and that sort of leads into my other question, which is, why did Richard Alpert want Paul's body?
I have no idea.
I mean, and actually, he was also specifically very interested in recovering the bodies of his own people, the two that were killed and buried.
I have no idea. I have no answer to that.
You know, again, I don't want to go into zombie territory necessarily, but we're moving into a place where there's some clear continuity of references to bodies and death, burials and revivals. If Christian Shepherd can come back, if Locke can come back, you know, if there's something going on with this island that given certain circumstances, people who are dead are not necessarily dead, I think this all kind of pulls into it. I think these are significant hints when Richard Alpert basically says, well, okay, you broke the truce, but what really matters, and the only thing that'll fix it is if we get all of these bodies. That's actually what's really important here. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I think there's...
I mean, with all the Egyptian stuff, I mean, maybe we're not dealing with zombies, but
right.
There might be something there.
I think so. And definitely some conversation on that coming up on our show. Do we know who Horace and Amy's son, the baby boy that was miraculously born through the intervention of Juliet, is? Do we know who that baby is?
I don't have any idea. I mean, my first thought was that it's either not relevant or it's somebody that it's not important yet. Maybe somebody we haven't even met yet.
Right. I mean, I don't think it's not relevant. In fact, a lot of the great theories out there kind of center around the fact that this baby shouldn't have been born
right.
If it weren't for the presence of Juliet. So that in many ways makes me wonder, but it can also therefore be what you're saying, that it's a character that we don't know, but a character who turns out to be pivotal because this character's existence is in fact a major change in the timeline. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, whoever the baby is, in fact, I think it'd be kind of brilliant if they say the baby is Bob or whatever, right?
Right.
And everybody's like, oh, who's Bob? Bob's nobody. That's great. But then it turns out, you know, we move back into the future back in 2004 when the crash happened, or 2007, that Bob is now there, that some significant things happened because this birth took place that apparently didn't happen. So I don't know. I'm not sure who the baby could be. I mean, basically you fast forward and say, okay, who was about, I don't know, 30 or so when we meet the Dharma Initiative in the 2000s, and it could be any of those characters. And some interesting names have come up. You'd mentioned Ethan was
mm-hmm.
one possibility, but I like the idea that it's someone we've not met. I like the idea that they might basically mess with that expectation. We all want it to be someone we know, so why not give us a surprise, especially since we're the last season and a half of Lost. There's going to be a lot of non-surprises because we've made a lot of connections that they're going to have
to
basically pay off.
True.
So why not mess with us a little bit more? I think that'd be kind of great.
That would be great.
So... any other moments in the episode that stood out for you that you really liked?
My favorite bit of dialogue is when Miles is teasing Sawyer. He says, we go to the beach, we go to the whatever. That's the only
orchid.
Two plans that you people have.
Right, absolutely. Again, you know, Miles is becoming a very important source of snark, especially as Sawyer, as we now see, has kind of elevated himself to leading man.
Uh-huh.
So we need someone to be cranky, and that's Miles. It was great.
He's like the voice of the fans in a lot of ways.
Right, again, he asks the realistic and the common sense questions, and so I definitely am enjoying his character a great deal. Of course, Sawyer did have some nicknames in this episode. He called the Faraday Plato, which makes sense when he's starting to get existential. But I didn't even couldn't even figure out what one nickname was until you explained. He called Enos.
Yeah.
And Enos is...
Well, he was the deputy sheriff on the Dukes of Hazzard.
Which, of course, is, again, perfect given that relationship. So I loved that. I like the needle drop in this episode. I like the song in this episode or the way they did it, because Lost is peppered with, you know, iconic music players. You have Desmond's record player. You have Juliet's CD player, which are both open season.
Hurley's portable CD player.
Oh, right. Way, way back when.
In season one.
I think that was a Damien Rice song that we really had to track down and enjoyed. So, yeah, there's all kinds of players that have been on the show. A track was...
Shambhala by Three Dog Night.
That's right, in the Dharma Van. So anyway, so as you can see, you know, whether it's video or audio, I can't think of a single media type that they haven't showcased. And so this was another great one. My dad had a reel-to-reel like that. I played with it all the time and recorded on it and wound it backwards and probably ruined a couple of good things that he had recorded. But again, old technology, new technology, it was just one of those moments that, again, kind of harkened back to some of my favorite moments in Lost, and was really well done.
So one of my other favorite shows is Friday Night Lights, and I noticed that Herc was on this episode.
Right, Herc is one of the hootenannying others in, this, in the Pearl, and what I thought was great is I loved Herc on Friday Night Lights. I loved Kevin Rankin's character, but more importantly, his character is very believable
as a
in a wheelchair.
Yes,
absolutely. So I just a really, really neat connection there, and you know, just a good actor to see given another opportunity.
That's the third Friday Night Lights Lost crossover. Yeah. Goodwin plays Riggins' dad, and Cassidy plays Saracen's mom.
Uh-huh. That's right. I'm forgetting all of these. Absolutely. A lot of good crossovers. Clearly, shows with great talent can recognize each other. I think that's fantastic. Even the new woman, Amy, is Reiko Aylesworth.
Yeah, she was on 24.
Absolutely. So, you know, no slouches in the drama department. Definitely good to see them on this show. So, well, I guess that's it. Normally, we also talk about locations, but this episode, there weren't any.
It was all Kualoa Ranch and...
probably the film studio, and that's it. I mean, the island's playing itself. But again, a very good episode. We enjoyed it a lot.
I loved it.
So that's our 2 cents. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we'll hear from you all, everybody.
Hey, Ron and Jim, what's up? It's John from North Carolina. Good episode. It was a pretty good episode. I liked it a lot. It wasn't as fast-paced. It wasn't as action-y, and it didn't have a lot of answers in it. And Widmore and stuff, but it was a pretty good character episode. It reminded me a lot of season one, season two, so that was good. Holy freaking crap, we gotta talk about the statue. Now, I went back and paused it. The statue looks Egyptian of some kind, and he's holding what it looks to be a rope in one hand, and something I can't tell what it is in the other hand. I don't think it's a lock or sword like people are thinking, because it clearly looks Egyptian or some type of race or something. The only problem I have is, how do they get this giant statue to disattach from its foot? I mean, because last time we saw it, the foot was four toast in there. So I don't think a tsunami hit or nothing. So unless Jughead is in the torso of this hunk of rock, I don't know how they knock it down or whatever. So that'll be interesting. Sawyer and Juliet, I love them together. They look perfect. They're the perfect couple. I'm just going to say it right now, if Kate comes between them two, Juliet's going to have to kill her, or else I'm going to kill her, because this is the perfect couple. They've already said they love each other, and if Kate comes between that, she should just go. Overall, I thought it was a good episode. I know a lot of people won't like it because it wasn't fast-paced like the rest of them, but I liked it a lot, and I can't wait to see what y'all think about it, so I'll talk to y'all later.
That was a call from our good friend John from North Carolina. He hits on the big two topics this week, Juliet and Sawyer versus Kate.
I'm a forker.
And the statue.
Well, on the statue, he kind of asked a fair question, which is, where'd it go? And I think there's some confusion for some folks as to when we saw the full statue. And of course, given that they're telling us that it's way back, before the well was even dug, which is now this is officially the earliest flashback we've had, even for a second. But, you know, it could be 1,000 years ago. It could be 600 BC, for all we know. Yeah. We don't know. Where did the statue go? I'm not sure. Tsunami is as good a guess as any, I don't think its destruction is necessarily going to be key, and I'm pretty sure Jughead had nothing to do about it.
No, I don't think so.
But definitely a fun call, as always. Thanks, John. But you're right, Jen. I think those were the two topics everybody wanted to talk about. Let's start with Sawyer and Juliet.
We have calls from Evan, Michelle, and Jackie.
Hey, Ryan and Jen, it's Evan from the mainland again.
So I'm kind of just wishing that Jack and Kate would have stayed home. I would have liked it if Sawyer and Juliet just got to live out their lives, but I guess that would make for very boring television. If Sawyer leaves Juliet for Kate, I'm going to be very mad. And I think if we're going to talk about symbolism between Bible characters and the Losties, that Kate would probably be playing the devil just because everything she touches turns to ash and she has this incessant need to ruin everything. At first, I was kind of hoping that Sawyer would get his wish and end up with Kate, but now that definitely changed for a lot of people. But it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out, and hopefully it goes in our favor, well, my favor at least. So, love the podcast. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Hi, Ryan and Jen. This is Michelle in New York, and I'm a little embarrassed because it's my first time calling, and what do I call about? Shipping. Yeah, very intelligent. But after having seen LaFleur, I think, with all due respect to the Kate fans out there, it's time for Freckles to go. It's just, you know, everybody's in a much more mature place now, except for Kate, and she's always been sort of holding everybody back in terms of maturity and emotion, whatever. And, yeah, basically I'd be fine if, you know, she disappeared and sort of be like, oh, hey, yeah, what happened to that chick? But yes, anyway, it's ironic that I'm calling you about this, as I haven't shipped anyone on Lost since they killed off my poor Charlie. But otherwise, LaFleur was a great episode up until the last couple of minutes there when, you know, we had the whole cheesy and delicious, oh my goodness, Sawyer, Kate, Jack, Juliet, Quadrangle, whatever. Just thought I would vent to you about that. And I love your podcast, and keep up the great work. Bye.
Hey, Ryan and Jen, it's Jackie from the Jersey Shore calling. Love the episode, actually. I thought it was much more character-driven. I'm much more into the character relationships in the show rather than the mythology, although I enjoy both. What really struck me was I had heard through some spoilers about the possible pairing of Juliet and Sawyer, and I was like, oh, God, you know, what are the writers going to try to force down our throats? Some meaningless relationship. I got to tell you, I thought it was probably the best relationship they've ever written on the show, and it was done in one episode. Maybe that's the key. But I think it doesn't bode well for her character because there's no way they're going to keep two people happy like that for a year and a half, which is what's left of the show. So I probably sense Juliet's ultimate demise so they can bring back the regular triangle, which is just so tired and played out. I wish they just keep things the way they are now. Anyway, love the podcast. As always, enjoy your show. I'm sorry we're going to miss Lost next week, but we really enjoy what you guys do, and we appreciate it, too. Take care. Bye.
All right. Thank you for those calls. And I got to say, it seems a fairly unified opinion about the relationships on the show. What do you think?
I think those calls pretty much sum it all up.
You know, part of me suddenly feels like I need to defend Kate a little. I mean, you're not a fan of Kate. So maybe there's sort of that demographic bias among our listeners. I mean, Evan is saying that, you know, I think she's Satan. It's just a little strong. I mean, one thing Evan says I agree with, which is part of me. I mean, I would consider myself a skater only insofar as I felt the most resonance with that possible relationship. But he says, you know, even though I kind of wanted Sawyer to get his hope, I like the way Sawyer is now. I like this Sawyer, this calm and mature Sawyer. And, you know, Michelle, embarrassed to be making her first call about a shipping thing, but that's what this episode was.
No,
it was
need to be embarrassed.
Don't worry about it. But she says something about Kate's maturity. And whether or not, you know, Evangeline Lilly is selling it, whether or not the writers are giving Kate enough runway to demonstrate her maturity, I think what they're trying to say happened with Kate during the Oceanic Six period is that she grew up. She settled down. She said Jack is the normal, regular, not too crazy person, and Aaron is important, and I need to be a good mom. I mean, there's all kinds of issues with that relationship, I agree. Maybe it's not one destined for survival either, but I think they were trying to say that Kate has matured. That might, in many ways, make her less interesting, but I wouldn't necessarily say that, you know, she's a guaranteed immature character.
Yeah, maybe not.
And as far as Sawyer goes, it bears pointing out that we liked him as the Han Solo scruffy, you know, rebellious character. And although we had a brief period of him now being domesticated and being at home and enjoying home cooking, maybe Sawyer might pull a Kate in so far as not being interesting if this continues. Maybe Sawyer isn't going to be the character we all love if he does settle down and become a home buddy.
I don't know. I think he's always going to be interesting. I think there's always going to be facets to him that we haven't seen. And I think he's going to continue to be interesting, but I don't know.
Well, getting to what Jackie was saying, do you believe that this basically is a death sentence for Juliet because it can't work out because they have to go back to the love triangle?
No, they don't have to go back to the love triangle. Why would they have to go back to the love triangle?
I don't know, because people are invested in that since season one, because there's a strong Jader and Skater contingent.
There were people invested in Shannon, but she's gone too.
Right. Very true. And Michelle mentioned Charlie, which of course was a draw for a lot of people. Yeah. And they stuck with the show despite the fact that they lost him as well. So I don't know. I guess there's a reason to stick around. I mean, it kind of makes me wonder, you know, things haven't gone well for people that Juliet's been in love with, obviously. Goodwin.
Yeah.
And even Sawyer. Well, actually, Sawyer's interesting. We think that he's a dog and a womanizer, but we've only seen him really fall for one woman, and
Cassie,
that's Cassidy.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if there's a long littered, if there's a big path littered with women who've come before or not. I would assume there is, but they haven't necessarily given us that impression.
No.
Interesting. Well, that was topic number one. Topic number two, of course, was the statue.
And here we have calls from Matt, Kyle, and Jeremy.
Hey, Ryan and Jen. This is Matt from Ohio, and I'm a first-time caller, long-time listener. And from watching last night's episode, which, by the way, I loved, I kind of got an idea about the statue. I haven't heard it mentioned yet, but seeing the long hair from the back reminded me a lot of the shot of Jacob in the cabin when Ben and Lot came to visit him in the help me scene when he was sitting in the chair. Anyway, that would kind of explain why the deity of the island in modern day would also be the deity of the island in the ancient times. That may be, all the theories about who it may be was also present back then, just a thought. I don't know. Tell me what you think.
Hey, Ryan and Jen, this is Kyle calling from Wisconsin. I just had a couple thoughts on the latest episode of Lost, LeFleur. First of all, awesome. I thought it was incredible. Definitely one of my favorite episodes so far. I mean, they're back in Dharma time. We get to see him working for Dharma, get a little bit of history, get to see the sub, we get to see the full statue. In my opinion, the biggest surprise, Sawyer settling down, living a family life with Juliet. Not quite a family, but settled into a comfortable life. So what I really wanted to talk about was the statue. That's something I've been waiting to see for a long time. I had to rewind and go back and look a couple times at it. And to me, it looked like a woman's body wearing a skirt, because you can see the long hair. But to me, it looks like it has animal ears when you go back and look at it, almost like it's a lion head. And to me, that kind of symbolizes like an Egyptian god or something with a lion head or a jackal head. And it might not even be a dress. That might just be Egyptian fashion. I mean, you always see them with almost like a skirt type clothing on. I don't know. You'd have to go back and look at it, because to me, that's what I saw. Another thought I had, kind of crazy theory, but Horace and Amy have a child. They have a boy conceived and born on the island. Obviously, this child's going to be special. So my thought was maybe that this child is going to be Jacob.
Ryan, Jen, Hollow, thank you for doing a great podcast. And I just want to share my theory from this last episode, a great episode, LeFleur. I love Sawyer-centric episodes. But this is actually about Richard Alpert, and really a big, kind of a theory about him and everything else on the island is with that statue that we saw from behind. It absolutely looked Egyptian to me. I think that's fairly obvious. Probably of Anubis is my guess. Four-toed Anubis, like dog. I don't know. And then of course with the Ankh, the Ankh necklace, and with Hurley drawing the Sphinx last episode, and just in the hieroglyphics, everything Egyptian. It is absolutely, in my opinion, that Richard Alpert is a pharaoh from, thousands of years ago. With the comments in regards to him looking like he's wearing eyeliner, and he looks like he could be a pharaoh. And it is very common in Egyptian culture for, to wear that sort of eyeliner. And I think that that's why they cast that that actor, is because he could get away with kind of doing, you know, is that the reason he has it? Is that the reason he has it? You know, I think it's solid theory. I don't think that's the end-all, be-all answer to the show, but I think it's going to be a big aspect of it, especially with the Egyptian mythology, Christian mythology, Buddhist mythology, just everything that there is. That's my theory, and I hope you like it. This is Jeremy from Boulder. Thanks.
Mahalo for those calls. Well, Matt saying that the statue could be a long-haired Jacob.
I don't know. To me, the statue really looks like from some kind of ancient culture. If not Egyptian, then maybe Mediterranean.
Right. For one thing, I'm not sure if Jacob is that far back. I still think Jacob is relatively contemporary to the island. The oldest we know now that Jacob might exist was when Locke mentioned him to Alpert when he showed up in 1955, and Alpert didn't flinch, like, who's Jacob? So that we know he was there. But and also, again, as Kyle kind of points out, the various features of this statue don't even look necessarily human, but that's certainly an interesting thought. So Kyle, definitely picking up on a lot of the elements. Many of our listeners did that it's Egyptian, probably not human, some kind of animal, but he does close his call with an interesting theory, which is that the baby that was born to Horace and Amy is Jacob. What do you think?
Well, like you were just saying, he was an issue back in 1955.
That's right.
So I'm thinking he's not quite that contemporary.
Yeah, I don't think he's quite that young. And, well, of course, when you've got time travel and people getting stuck in time, who knows what it'll eventually be. But I'll also be on the baby is not Jacob side of the bandwagon. And finally, Jeremy from Boulder remembering to tell us who he was and also saying that, you know, this all ties to Egyptianness. And in fact, hey, you've got Richard Alpert and his eyeliner even mentioned in this episode. That's kind of like a pharaoh, kind of an Egyptian. What is a pharaoh?
A pharaoh is a king, was an ancient Egyptian king.
Mm-hmm. So you think he's a pharaoh?
He could be. That's as good a guess as any, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, when you make all of the ties to all of the Egyptian things and the Ankh and stuff like that and Hurley and his drawing, I think that's definitely a perfectly reasonable conclusion
to
make.
Well, I mean, Juliet does say that he's always been here, and somebody else has said that he's very, very old. So ancient Egypt is very, very old. I guess that qualifies.
I would agree with that. Well, I think we're going to detour quickly into our blog, although we have more voicemails coming up. The blog comments is really where a lot of this fantastic statue conversation took place.
Emily in Colorado thinks it's the goddess Bastet. She writes, if you Google Bastet, which is fun because there are many cool images, you will see that the statue is similar, but what really struck me was the cross that Paul was wearing when he died and which Amy kept in honor of Paul's memory. It is in nearly every picture of the Bastet statue. In some depictions, the statue is holding this cross, and others it's behind her. Also, when you Google her images, you find she has only four toes. Bastet is the goddess of pregnant women and home, and the Lady of the East, where Sekhmet is the Lady of the West. Sekhmet was a lioness-headed goddess of war and destruction. Bastet was the goddess of fire, cats, and home, and pregnant women. According to one myth, she was the personification of the soul of Isis. She was also called the Lady of the East. As such, her counterpart as Lady of the West was Sekhmet.
So, of course, Emily pointing out that she likes the various Wizard of Oz connotations there as well. But, you know, Bastet works, you know, goddess of pregnant women. And the Ankh, if you do go back to watch that brief shot of the statue, there is something in either of her hands. One or both may, in fact, be giant Ankhs, like you will see in some of these Googled images. So definitely cool. John Fisher did a little more research. He writes, the statue appears male from its dress. It has short, perhaps feline ears, yet we know it has four toes, so it could be part bird. It's holding an Ankh in its right hand and something else in its left. I think it's important then to find a god holding an Ankh in its hand. That would indicate any one of these male gods. Anubis, Horus, or Seth. And he also writes, note the Phoenicians adopted many of the Egyptian gods and tweaked them a bit to suit their purpose. Interestingly, their capital was Carthage, located in modern-day Tunisia. Did the Phoenicians, famous for their seafaring ability, discover the island? So, John helping us kind of narrow down our Egyptian gods because of the Ankh. Yeah. But also, I really like pointing out the Phoenicians and, you know, how they were seafaring peoples and that they kind of adapted the Egyptians.
Yeah, and the reference to Carthage also.
Absolutely. Very cool there, John. Very helpful.
Kat writes, I think the statue is Anubis, a jackal-headed god associated with mummification and the afterlife in Egyptian mythology. And if you look at Anubis, it holds the same Ankh that is Paul's necklace. Anubis is Egyptian with which links with the hieroglyphics and is also the symbol for the afterlife. How ancient Egyptians, resurrection, and the afterlife fit, we have yet to know.
Well, of course, maybe we don't, because, of course, we have Richard Alpert, who doesn't seem to age. We have issues with the bodies coming back to life. And, you know, again, a real obsession with death or a state after death, which I think is definitely coming to the fore. So a lot of really good connections there with Anubis, who's associated with mummification and the afterlife. Very cool. Now, Chrissy from Sydney says, I was thinking that the statue could be Horus. Horus in hieroglyphics looks like the countdown timer hieroglyphics. Interestingly, Horus is what is known as a life, death, rebirth deity in Egyptian mythology. That ties really well with Locke and maybe Christian. Horus is also a god of war. Also interesting, of course, is that Horus sounds exactly like Horus. And while on the topic of Egyptian gods, what about Ra, who is a sun god? Ra, Richard Alpert. Re or Ra was the Egyptian sun god who was also often referred to as Re or Horakhti, meaning Re is Horus of the horizon. So many, many more connections going on there.
Yeah, I don't think it's an accident that Horus sounds like Horus.
No, not at all. And Anubis, again, a lot of similar things kind of connecting these different Egyptian gods or goddesses about life and afterlife, but you know, Horus being a good one because we have a character named Horus, so very, very cool.
Chili Dog writes, four-toed statue is the Egyptian god Seth. Seth is considered the complement to Horus. Seth is a god of chaos, infertility, and is associated with deserts, destructive acts of nature, and is a protector of the barge to the underworld. Seth killed his brother by drowning him in a coffin and then cutting him up into little pieces. This brother of his would become the god of the dead and would open up the afterlife. Seth is all at once evil and revered. If Seth did not kill his brother, there would be no afterlife.
So another good case there for yet another god, but Seth sounds a little more nefarious and dark there.
Yeah, definitely.
But I kind of like it because of the story of Seth and what he did to his brother and how that event created the afterlife and was sort of a gateway to that. And in many ways, it could be a theory of what the island is historically.
Yeah, very interesting.
Cool. So, you know, you've got Chili Dog saying Seth and Chrissy saying Horus and Kat saying Anubis and a lot of these excellent thoughts about what it is, but Ben kind of comes in with a little more realistic view. Ben writes, from the look of the statue, I feel they made it purposely vague to show that it really had little significance, if any, to the show as a whole. It was almost as if they were blowing it off in just a few seconds. See? Something existed there once, now it's gone, get over it, and that's okay by me. So what do you think? Much ado about nothing?
Well, I once said if they didn't get around to the four-toed statue, I'd be all right with that.
Right, and they nearly threw you out of the room. But that's possible. I do not think that this was their saying, now we're done. I think there's something else there.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've also been wrong.
Yeah.
Let's get back to the voicemails.
We have calls from Andy, Mario, and Mr. Jacob.
Hey, Ryan and Jen. This is Andy in Chicago, first-time caller. I've been listening for a while, though, to your podcast. I think it's great. I think it's the best one out there. So I have a theory about Alpert, because every time he's on, you hear all these theories about how he's time-traveling or how he's not human. And I just don't believe that, because if you go to, like, Lostpedia, you can find information about, like, Life Extension Project, LEP, and things of that nature associated with, like, Alvar Hanzo. So I think that Alpert just is not aging, just like some other characters that we have seen that don't age, and I can't remember which ones, but I feel like there's been others that do not age as well. And I think it's all tied to this Life Extension Project thing that's tied in with Alvar Hanzo. Anyway, great podcast, great episode this week, and that's it. Thanks.
Hello, Ryan and Jen. It's Mario calling from Houston, Texas, and I really enjoyed last night's episode. I know there'll be debate about character-driven lovey-dovey and mythology episodes, but I like a well-rounded TV show, and Lost definitely excels at that. For me, the highlights was the way the previously on Lost rolled right into the episode, had me doing a double take, and obviously the reveal of the statue, which what I understand is Horus, the Egyptian bird god, which I think it has a tie into Hurley's Sphinx drawing. That was awesome. And then lastly, for me, the conversation and the scene between Sawyer and Richard was just very intense. I love the way Sawyer was in complete control of the conversation, totally blowing Richard's mind. Was a great character highlight for Sawyer. I'm going to be going into withdrawal next week, so you guys keep up the good work, and we'll talk to you soon.
Aloha, Ryan and Jen. This is Mr. Jacob from Not in Portland. My fiance and I loved LaFleur. We loved the Sawyer centricity, especially since we haven't had one of those since the beginning of season three. Loved how Sawyer was searching for the missing losties. It's nice to know they're still looking for, you know, the Roses and Bernards and some red shirts and maybe even Claire. Loved the focus on Juliet, perhaps having her baby delivering issues resolved, which was very nice. And it's always nice to see Elizabeth Mitchell because she's so stunningly beautiful. The only thorn on my side is Richard Alpert. Why wasn't Alpert in long hair, dirty clothes mode like he was when he met young Ben? And what on earth did he want with Paul's body? Very strange stuff. Anyway, quick question for you guys. Do you ever think we'll get a character-based, non-Dharma-related flashback to the events before the plane crash by the end of the series? In other words, a character-based season 1-3 styled flashback? I know that it might deplete some of the great momentum that the show is going right now, but I still think it'd be a nice little throwback to a very different time on Lost. And there's still some unanswered questions from the Losties' past, like Sawyer's Tampa job and Saeed's Basra incident, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, awesome episode, awesome show, and awesome podcast. We love you guys. Take care.
Thanks for those calls. So Andy's saying that this is all tied to a life extension project and those experiments from the game. The
wow, we haven't heard about that in a while.
Yeah, actually, the thing that is an issue is that that was a lot of work and a lot of mythology created for that alternative reality game, and I don't think any of that has necessarily paid off.
No,
in the show.
I don't even
one.
Think anybody's even explicitly said the name Alvar Hanso.
Right,
yet.
But well, so maybe that could be it. Richard Alpert is part of that. But
sure.
But that would mean, I think, that Richard Alpert becomes ageless only once he gets involved in a life extension project. And everything that I've read about Alvar Hanso and all of that experimentation and the Dharma Initiative puts it in the 70s, the 80s, fairly industrialized times.
Right.
And we now know that Richard Alpert's been ageless since at least the 50s and conceivably from much, much more before that.
Right.
So that's the only other thing. But it was definitely a good reminder of some mythology that we've not touched on. The only reason why I think time travel might still be an element for Alpert's character is that we also just had Charles Widmore explicitly mentioned to Locke, you know, it's fascinating. It was 20 years ago and you look exactly the same. I mean, the only other time I think that was explicitly said that, why is it with this character that doesn't change? And in that case, it was definitely because of turning the frozen donkey wheel and being teleported.
That's right.
Now, Mario from Houston saying that the intro was fantastic.
Yeah,
I
like that.
Mindbender, and that it's a well-rounded show. Definitely something that he liked. Sawyer blowing Richard's mind was great. And also he's going to withdraw next week.
Yeah, well, I will be too.
Yeah, not much to disagree with there. And finally, Mr. Jacob and his fiance kind of pointing out a couple of cool things. Yes, Sawyer is searching for the other characters. He mentions Rose and Bernard. That's a big one. I'm not sure if anyone's mentioning Rose and Bernard.
Yeah, what happened to poor Rose and Bernard? Nobody even asks about them.
But it is reasonable, or it is a nice touch that he is not giving up, that, you know, a lot of people were kind of having an issue with, why are they pretending that all these other people weren't there? Let's just pretend, at least, that Sawyer was looking for Rose and Bernard and wondering what happened to the rest of their people. But good question. Why was Richard Alpert not long-haired hippie Alpert that appears to Ben very soon?
I don't know. I still haven't figured out the whole dynamic they had with the, you know, with the disguises. I know that there was a purpose to their disguises and to the way they presented themselves, and I haven't really decided what that is yet.
Right. Well, I think that in some respects, you know, maybe Alpert, when he had the long hair and kind of had that groovy appearance for young Ben, was that he was trying to be a little less threatening, maybe, kind of look like the long-haired hippies in the Dharma Initiative?
Yeah.
I don't know. But and his other question was, do you think we're going to see any more of the stories of our lost characters before the crash? Is there any room for that in the next year and a half?
Not in how many episodes we have left? Less than 25,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. 17 plus 7, so.
Yeah. I don't think we really want to see anymore. I think that we found out everything that is relevant about them. At least I think so.
I think there are so many unanswered questions about our favorite characters from season one. I think there are entire characters now,
Libby,
whose stories... Right, Libby. There's a lot that is yet to be told, but I just don't see where that can fit now. I just don't know where the room is, unless they completely blow our minds, as they just might, and come up with a completely different paradigm for season six, another way for those last 17 episodes to reintroduce or recover stories and cover all of that stuff. I just don't see how they can do it. And I agree with you. I think that to some extent, just like with this episode and the missing 3 years, maybe our imagination should suffice for answering those questions.
Maybe.
Well, let's take one more call. Who we got?
Here's Drew.
Hey, Ryan and Jen, long-time listener, first-time caller. My name is Drew. I'm calling from beautiful Nova Scotia, Canada. Just wanted to thank you guys for what you do. You make me seem so much smarter around my friends than I actually am. let me just say, last night's episode, Lost is always, it's always cryptic and confusing, but I've never really not been able to wrap my mind around what was happening, like what happened last night before the initial Lost across the screen. When that came up, I just looked at my friends and said, I have no idea what's happening, and everyone in the room agreed. What a great opening sequence that we rewatched probably what, 3 or 4 times. Just a little thing I had go through my mind last night, it's probably been brought up by people before, but with the whole Christian thing and the parallels that they've been drawing with Locke, I think before the end of the season, we're going to find out, probably in the next couple episodes even, that Christian is from the islands, be it part of the Dharma Initiative or with Richard Alpert and the others, or the Hostiles, whatever you want to call them, and that's going to be why he's able to come back to life. This is in the same way that Locke did when he comes back to the, when he came back to the island in the initial 8:15 flight. So I think that'll be pretty cool when and if that happens. I love that there's been all this, Damon and Carlton have acknowledged the fact that all the everyone's looking for the statue right now. So what they do, last night, they do a flash, the statue is there in front of us, and then another flash and it's gone. Just awesome. I love that they tease us for stuff like that. It drives me crazy, but it's why I watch the show. Other than that, keep doing it. I love it. I love the podcast. Like I said, you make me seem so much smarter around my friends. Keep it up, and have a great day.
Mahalo, Drew. And hey, yeah, we're glad that we can help you look like a bigger geek in front of your friends. I'm not sure if that's entirely something to be
our
proud
pleasure.
Of, but we're happy to do it. And just many things to agree with there. He agreed with Mario that the opening scene was mind-blowing and kind of hard to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
We love that about Lost. Also saying we're getting totally messed with the statue, but that's why we love it. Absolutely agree with it there. And his main point being Christian was a factor on the island and that his resurrection, as we saw with Jack, is what happened with Locke coming back, and I don't think there's any disagreement there.
No, I absolutely agree.
I mean, we've already kind of come to the conclusion, I believe, that Jack's grandfather is also tied to the island
Ray,
somehow.
Yeah. Well, I don't think he would have been introduced if he weren't that big of a deal.
Right. So you've got Ray, you've got Christian, you've got Jack, and you've got Aaron and Claire. So that I'm perfectly happy with that being something that we're going to see is central to the whole show, and I love that they're giving us all of these little pieces. So all good stuff. Well, we talked a lot about how much we love this episode, but we're all about hearing all sides, so we have one dissenting view on the episode.
Thomas writes, I really hate these character-driven episodes. This one reminded me of season 3.
Oh.
If it weren't for the four-toed statue shot and the conversation between Sawyer and Richard, I would rate this one in the bottom 10 of all-time Lost episodes. Mm. As it were, it was very weak. People are being murdered everywhere you look, smoke monsters that kill people, and weird cults like the others and Dharma are all around. Who'd want to live like that? No one, that's who. You get a chance off Wacko Island on a submarine and you don't take it? Sorry, I'm not buying it.
Well, I mean, I think we also agreed that, you know, Miles, for example, we're not sure what his story is and what keeps him on the island, but this episode was as bad as the worst of season 3, bottom 10 of all episodes. I think we got to say, I hear what you're saying,
but you're completely wrong. Just go with it, dude. Just go with it, okay? It would be a really short and boring show if everybody left.
Or if that's true, too.
Just go watch Heroes.
Oh, burn. Let's just move on, please. Rob from West Virginia writes, or emails, I think that it might be possible that our Losties, Sawyer, etc., might have altered the course of history, or at least Dharma. When we see Horus killed by Ben and the natives in the Purge, he is only a worker at the Arrow. No mention of any leadership role. So he would have to have been leader many years earlier. Is there any way he was demoted? I don't think so. When Horus meets newborn Ben outside of Portland, he is with Olivia, the blonde schoolteacher. Ben's teacher. If Horus was leader in the late 70s, he hasn't met baby Ben yet. If you were to ever meet him on the side of the road, it would have to be way earlier than the 70s, because Ben is definitely in his 40s. The timeline doesn't add up. Perhaps Horus doesn't take the sub back with Olivia because he never marries her. He marries Amy, the woman that Sawyer saved from being killed, who would have been killed if they didn't intervene. No good deed goes unpunished. Sawyer saving that woman altered the future events. So now Horus is married, has a son, never marries Olivia, never meets baby Ben on the side of the road, never bring him to the island. Interesting. So what is he saying, basically?
Well, that If Sawyer hadn't prevented Amy from getting killed, he wouldn't have met Olivia. If he hadn't met Olivia, they wouldn't have run into Ben. If they hadn't run into Ben, who knows what would have happened.
Well, first of all, well, I mean, it's a fair question because we asked each other after mm-hmm. we watched this episode, what happened to Olivia, who was the woman that Horace was tootling around with, it seemed, in the car. But I think you had said, well, we never heard that they were actually a couple. They might have just been colleagues in the Dharma Initiative.
Well, apparently in the pop-up version of Cabin Fever, they explain that she's his wife, Olivia.
Olivia is, okay, well, then that kind of throws that. Well, actually, when he says the timeline doesn't add up, I'm not sure if that's true because he's writing as if the encounter with, or you know, the marriage or the relationship with Amy comes before, but it doesn't. It's actually the other way around. When we see Horace Goodspeed and Olivia, his wife, discover Ben on the side of the road, that's way before the 70s, or at least significantly before the 70s,
right?
Because we know Ben arrives on the island in the late 70s as a young boy. So I think it's fair to ask whatever happened to Horace's leadership position when he just becomes a mathematician, when we see him welcome Ben, and that welcoming of Ben is going to be very contemporary to what we just saw in Lafleur. But this whole period with Olivia predates the time with Amy. So if anything, Olivia is Horace's ex-wife, mm-hmm. but not, I don't think, I mean, I don't think there's a conflict there. I don't think that they've changed anything yet. Apart from the question is, how is Horace just a mathematician when we saw him before and where he seems to be running everything now? The only answer I have to that is that it looks like Horace's territory is Othersville, you know, sort of right. The domestic cabin residential area of the island. And that's consistent. He's welcoming young Ben. Come, you're going to come live with us. Here's, you know, he's sort of got that sort of tour guide facility management sort of position, but he mm-hmm. can still be a mathematician as well. But,
and I need an aspirin.
Yeah, certainly a fair question, though, to be sure.
Sydney writes, it seems like Richard has visited John Locke after someone spoke to him about John. What I mean is that when John visited Richard in 54, Richard showed up at John's birth in 56, and when Lafleur talks to Richard in 74, I assume that was right before Locke was placed in a locker at high school and offered to go to the science camp in Portland. When Richard tells John he must die, did he already get the info from the resurrected Locke about Ben killing him and coming back to life on his mission to get back to the island?
Again, another headache question, but actually I think that was a good point. What I like about Richard Alpert's character now is imagine this story we've seen so far from his point of view. He's wandering around on the island and these mysterious people come and John Locke says, I'm going to be your boss. Come see me get born. So he goes to see him get born and, well, there's nothing remarkable about this baby. Forget it. And then he's tooling around the island and this strange Sawyer character comes up, or Lafleur comes up and says, John Locke is coming back. I'm waiting for him to return. So you're like, all right, fine. I'm going to go check on this John Locke and see what he's up to. I mean, basically, from his point of view, if his timeline is consistent and straight through, he's being told all the time how important John Locke is.
Right.
Which brings us right back to season 3 where he says, well, you're important, John, and you're here, and we think you need to replace Ben. So I do like that sort of aspect of the story. But do you think that Richard tells John he must die because there was that conversation had already happened or happened prior to that experience?
I don't know.
We say uncle. Dave writes, I love the idea, suggested by several posters and essentially confirmed here, that the Losties make their own mythology. Well, here you go. Sawyer heard of the Black Rock and mentioned it to Alpert, who may have mentioned it to Widmore and bred his fascination. Sawyer tells Alpert he saw Jughead and is waiting for Locke the Savior. Sawyer Lafleur helps stave off what is likely the Purge. Very Donnie Darko predestination paradox course correcting. Well, that's certainly one way to look at it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm cautious about predicting that they keep the Purge from happening because mm-hmm. we really don't know at this point how the Purge is going to happen.
Well, you know, thinking about the timeline, we know for a fact that two major incidents are coming up in the future of the island from the point of Lafleur. The Purge is going to happen, and the incident has yet to happen. I'm pretty sure it has yet to happen, because the incident is in the time of Marvin Candle and all of that, so mm-hmm. that's early 80s or thereabouts. So the thing about the Purge, reason why I don't think the Purge is going to enter into it is that the Purge happened when Ben was an adult. That puts it way in the 90s, probably. Or around
true.
That period of time. And I certainly do not think that we're going to see Sawyer, Juliet, Kate, Jack, and Hurley stick around on the island for 20 years for the Purge to happen. That leaves only the incident. And so my theory has been, and someone definitely posted on the blog as well, is that the incident is coming, and that the incident very most likely is a major disturbance in the space-time continuum that may be our friends, the survivors of Oceanic Flight 815, jumping back to 2007.
That would be an incident, yes.
I think that would be definitely something significant to affect the island, but definitely a good thought. And, you know, we got to mention every time someone mentions Donnie Darko.
Carmel writes, wild guess, Amy's baby is Desmond. You see, if it were Carl or Ethan, it wouldn't be that important since they're dead and they weren't Dharma anyway. It's got to be someone that got off the island as a kid before the purge, and we probably don't even assume he's an ex-islander. If it is Desmond and he is given to a Scottish family before the purge to be saved, he is special because he couldn't have been born without Juliet's time travel. How's that idea for you?
Well, what do you think?
No, I don't know. My instinct tells me it's not Desmond.
Well, I wasn't thinking that it was Desmond either until her last point, which is that, well, this baby that was born to Amy and Horace wasn't supposed to be born, but was. By
That's
some
true.
Strange intervention of someone messing with the timeline. So if that could be one thing that makes Desmond special, then why not? Interesting thought, Carmel. Christy in Texas writes, I have no idea either why Richard Alpert wants Paul's body, especially in the name of justice, but I did recall one other funeral, so I looked it up on Lostpedia. In season 3's The Cost of Living, Colleen Pickett, who was shot by Sun, was set afloat on a funeral pyre and set to sea. Perhaps there's a connection between whether a body is buried, like the Losties, cremated, like Colleen, or left exposed, like the Dharma Initiative from The Purge, to include Ben's dad left in the van, or even in a wood coffin, Christian Shepherd and Locke, and whether they can be of any further use to the island. I'm sure I'm missing some other ways dead bodies were exposed, but anyway, any idea on correlations? I think Richard Alpert wanted to know where the bodies were buried so they could be recovered for whatever their preferred method of handling them was. What do you think?
Well, I just now realized that somebody asks Ben what they want him to do with their dad, and he says, just leave him.
Excellent point. And I think Christy raises a good point here about how bodies are handled and whether that may or may not involve how they could come back. I mean, like we said, it seems Richard Alpert is very concerned about the physical integrity of the bodies of both their lost two men and Paul.
Yes.
So I think definitely on to something there. Egyptian reincarnation, who knows what it is.
Mummies.
But it's certainly key. I think we got one more comment.
Ryan writes, what do you make of the Dharma time period apparently allowing conception through birth while the other's time period was very different, leading Ben to even bring Juliet to the island to help find a solution?
And that's Ryan in Miami, and I think that's a fair question. You're saying in 1977 and Juliet now with the Dharma and the LaFleur time period that you can have a baby, but we know that other than that there's been this issue with people not being able to have babies, so the assumption is that whatever it is that causes people to not have babies, as Sawyer says, hasn't happened yet, and what that incident might be. But I'm not so sure, because in this episode, the Dharma doctor who freaks out specifically mentions that we send our women to the mainland to have babies. So maybe there was always an issue, and there is still persistent an issue with this, but that they got around it by basically shipping their women off to somewhere else. What of course throws the wrench into that is that, yes, this is a baby that was born on the island through Juliet's intervention. So I'm not sure.
Do say that the baby is 2 weeks early.
Right. So it's premature.
And Locke was premature. And Ben was premature.
Okay. Well, there you go. So maybe the babies that are special are early, but survive against all odds. So
possibly.
you've got Locke definitely surviving against. I mean, Locke was incredibly premature.
Yes.
And Ben's birth was also kind of unexpected and rather graphic. So I don't know. I mean, I think maybe we're onto something there. That I think fertility and birth is still an issue. I'm not sure if there's an incident that, as Sawyer predicts, that causes the infertility coming up, or that it's still something that was always there and persistent. But there's something special about these babies. Either way, I'm curious to find out.
Yeah, me too.
Well, we've done it once again. We've rambled our way well past an hour with all of the great feedback from you all, everybody. But what can we say? We love it all.
Yes, we do. So please call us on the Lost Line at 808-356-0127. Drop us an email at lost@hawaiiup.com or leave a comment on the blog at hawaiiup.com/lost.
Now, definitely keep those contact methods in mind, because of course Lost is going to be taking a week off, so we want to hear from you when the next new episode airs on the 18th. This upcoming week, we are taking a week off just like the show,
yep.
In part because we'll love the break, but in part because I will be, as I mentioned, in Austin for the South by Southwest Interactive Conference. Now, it'll be my first such event. I'm going to be all bright-eyed and overwhelmed. But if you think you might be wandering those halls, or if you're in Austin, who knows? We might be able to hook up. So definitely drop me a line, or you can follow me on Twitter at Hawaii as I post completely naive and overwhelmed comments about everything that's going on. It'll be quite a trip. All right. Well, that's it for you all, everybody. That means it's time to move into the Forward Cabin.
This is where we hide production news, rumors, spoilers, and all that fun stuff. So if you don't want to know what's coming up, you might want to skip ahead.
Welcome to the Forward Cabin, the forward-looking part of the transmission. We'll start, as always, with the preview for our next new episode, which unfortunately is coming up in 2 weeks. In any case, what did the ABC announcer say is coming up on Lost?
Pearly yells, "I can't believe it," and hugs Sawyer. Sun is holding a ring on the beach. Sawyer tells them to stay put. Ben comes through the jungle. Sawyer says, "I gotta find a way to bring them in before they screw everything up that we got here." Jin finds Saeed. Someone says, "He's a spy." The announcer says, "Loyal ties will be tested." And somebody else says, "We can end this. We can shoot him."
All right. Well, definitely looks like a great episode, but that'll be on March 18th. The episode is entitled Namaste, and the synopsis from ABC reads, "When some old friends drop in unannounced, Sawyer is forced to further perpetuate his lie in order to protect them." Well, I guess that's what we're going to have to wait to see. As far as filming here on the island, not too much was reported, although, of course, they've been very busy. They're moving into the last two episodes of filming. Yes, that includes the season finale. Now, I mentioned last week in the Forward Cabin there was a hospital scene. Well, I got a few more details from someone who works at the hospital. They said Desmond was there for sure. Penny was there, and a little boy and a girl, but both of them were playing Charlie. That's their young son. But I said last week that I thought Charles Widmore was there. My friend said, I'm not sure. I thought it was Mrs. Hawking that was there. And that might make it even more interesting. Who knows? Other than that, just sort of passing word of a late shoot on Friday at Waimea Falls Park. That's, of course, the waterfall park and a jungle area.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, that fan was just sort of passing through the neighborhood. Didn't get to stop to see much. Although he said that a guard mentioned it was a scene with Locke, the bald dude, and Alpert. So what does that mean? What does it imply? I'm not sure. I guess we're just going to have to wait to find out.
Yep.
Well, that's it for the Forward Cabin. Nice and short and sweet. And of course, that means that's it for this episode of The Transmission. One last time, we're taking a week off. I'll be traveling to Austin for South by Southwest, but we will be back the following week for the next new episode of Lost called Namaste. Please remember that The Transmission is available in both MP3 and enhanced AAC format, so you can skip around. You can find links to both on our blog or also in the iTunes Music Store. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening.
Stay lost.
Aloha. Aloha.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lost Podcasting Network. Get all your favorite Lost podcasts in one feed at lostcasts.blogspot.com.